Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools, VEA, teaching, learning, leading, online at veanea.org.
Welcome to Assembly Conversations. You're listening to Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. 1 week into its 2011 session, the Virginia General Assembly is settling down to business and even killing a few of the more than 1,900 bills and resolutions expected to keep it busy, along with budget amendments, until the end of February. Joining us for this discussion of Virginia's legislative session are three veteran political reporters with a great deal of experience covering Virginia's politics and its legislature. Christina Knuckles is an editorial writer and former reporter with the Virginian Pilot from Hampton Roads, who has also previously worked in Roanoke and Lynchburg. Welcome, Christina.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you on the program. Shelian Davis is a government and politics reporter with the Fredericksburg Freelance Star, who has also covered the legislature for the Lynchburg News and Daily Advance. Welcome, Shelian.
Thank you.
And Bob Lewis is a veteran political writer and reporter for the Associated Press here in Richmond at the Richmond Bureau. Bob has covered politics and other government beats for the AP and other states in the Midwest and South, from Indiana to Kentucky and Arkansas. Welcome, Bob.
Good to be here, Brother Bob.
Glad you're here. I'm your host, Bob Gibson, Executive Director of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership at the University of Virginia. Please give us a call, 1-866-611-NEWS, that is 866-611-6397, if you have a question for our distinguished panel of journalists. Bob, a few bills in the General Assembly revolve around climate change research and involve academic freedom and investigations into potential fraud, as well as involving the Virginia Freedom of Information Act. Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli and fellow global warming skeptic Delegate Bob Marshall are seeking separate emails and records, separately seeking the same emails and records, it turns out, from the University of Virginia involving former UVA environmental scientist Michael Mann, who left UVA in 2005 to go to Penn State. Now Senators Chap Peterson and Don McEachin and Delegate David Toscano of Charlottesville have a bill targeting Cuccinelli's investigation. The bill would repeal sections of a Virginia law giving the Attorney General authority to issue civil investigative demands similar to subpoenas to get documents in relation to civil investigations conducted by the Attorney General's office. UVA, which has already spent $350,000 to resist Cuccinelli's attempts to get Mann's emails and documents from UVA, is trying to charge Bob Marshall $8,000 for his FOI of the same documents, and Bob has an FOI bill. Where is this dispute going in the legislature?
I don't know whether you read my mind or just read the story I filed to the wire.
Haven't seen it yet.
McEachin and Chap Peterson are trying to foreclose the 2002 law that gave the Attorney General the authority to issue these civil investigative demands. And they say that Ken Cuccinelli has far exceeded the authority that he was granted under that act. They say that what he's done amounts to a political witch hunt, and that the upshot of it is no researchers, no universities from outside of Virginia would dare come in here in a climate like this and risk a major, highly funded project that's very sensitive politically with someone perceived to be a crusading attorney general who might go in there and use a CID to get their private memos, to get their hypotheses, their unfinished research work that's not ready for the public yet. So it's part of the Democrats' response, I think, to the Republicans' effort to federalize this race. You've seen it in the repeal amendment, which died in a Senate subcommittee
this
morning.
3-2 today.
Right. The right to work constitutional amendment that was passed overwhelmingly today in the House. The Republicans watched last year's results and saw that a new conservative strain was aligning itself with the Republican Party. Call it Tea Party if you like. Call it some of these other groups like Americans for Prosperity. But they are all about rushing to please that constituency on the right, and you've seen it in a number of bills they've put in so far this year, that has two tracks. One, they're gambling that if they can make this another election, even though it's legislative in nature, this fall against Washington, against Barack Obama, against Harry Reid in the Senate, Democrats, and even against Nancy Pelosi, though she's in a much lesser role, they can win just like they did last fall. Also, they of more pressing and immediate interest, they see that if they can stake the high ground on these positions to the right of potential opponents, they might avoid a primary.
Bob Lewis is the Richmond reporter covering the General Assembly for the Associated Press. Christina Knuckles, what do you see? Is this bill political? Is this bill substantive? Is this bill both?
Well, I think at least two of the sponsors are planning statewide runs, so I would say, yes, it's a political bill. And on the other flip side of that, I would say that most things that Ken Cuccinelli does are political in nature as well. I think that people on both sides of this are highly attuned to the politics of this debate.
So what do you think is going to happen to the bill? Is it just going to get caught up in the Republican-controlled House of Delegates and die?
You're asking me? I think so, yeah.
Yeah. Shelley, what do you think?
I agree with Bob. Yes, I think that it'll probably pass the Senate since the Senate is controlled by the Democrats, and it will die an agonizing death on the House side.
Or a swift death.
Swift death.
An entertaining death.
A swift death at 7 o'clock in the morning in a subcommittee meeting.
Right.
A recorded vote.
Who's covering Delegate Toscano's bill tomorrow morning at 7 o'clock?
Adam Rue from Channel 29, and good luck to him.
They do that down here. They schedule subcommittees at 7 o'clock in the morning, and reporters struggle sometimes to be fully awake at that hour. But I guess that's the way the Assembly works, so that they don't have what they used to have, which was subcommittees meeting all at the same time at more sane hours during the day. What's different about this session, Bob?
Well, what was unusual in that it opened right after those horrific shootings in Arizona was the facade of civility. And today I saw that crumble on the House floor. The Republicans exercised their majority power and on a mostly party line vote voted up the right to work constitutional amendment. Democrats argued fiercely that it was a labor baiting bill and, as Ward Armstrong called it, a solution in search of a problem because we have a very strong right to work law already in statute. But the Republicans argue that, no, we need it in the Constitution. Well, Armstrong stands up at the end of the debate and says, well, you know, I guess I should feel good that it took us a whole week to actually get involved in raw politics on the House floor. I'm shocked that that happens. But I don't know that this session is that much different from others. Short sessions like this, you have the usual grandstanding. You have everybody scrambling to protect their reelectability, for lack of a better word. You have everybody worried about redistricting. That clouds where they're going to be. You don't know that your district is going to be your district after the April reconvened session and the House and Senate get in there and redraw the lines. So that adds a certain element of tension to it.
Christina Knuckles, how do you see the atmosphere of this session differing from any previous sessions you've been here for?
I would say the heightened level of insecurity on all sides. From the governor's perspective, he's in his second year now. He didn't get as much done in the first year. He's got a ton of very complicated plans. He's asking legislators, you know, on the first start of the session to read a 94-page report on ABC privatization, still working on his higher ed plan, a huge bond package that is complicated and has some legislators scared. So he's worried about what he can accomplish now as the load of complex projects that he has accumulated gets heavier and heavier. The Republicans in the House of Delegates are worried because they have this concern. They don't know what their districts are going to look like. They don't know how many Tea Party people are going to be in those districts and how many of those people are going to want to run. It's very hard in redistricting. It's a little bit easier in redistricting to figure out maps when you're just dividing up the Republicans and the Democrats. But when you're trying to figure out who's going to run against you in a primary, there's no software to help you through that one. And then on the Senate side, the Democrats with a very narrow majority trying to figure out how they can hold on to that. And with a lot of folks who are getting to retirement age, and they're starting to realize it's not just about drawing the maps, but it's about recruiting new folks to show up. So I think all parties are really thinking about their future, and that leads to a tendency to people to cling to the status quo.
Thank you, Christina Knuckles. You're listening to Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. Please give us a call, 1-866-611-NEWS. That's 866-611-6397 if you have a question for our distinguished journalists, Christina Knuckles, Bob Lewis, and Shellyann Davis. Shellyann, is Virginia about to get out of the business of selling booze?
I don't think so.
What's going to happen? The governor has a new proposal that he's just put forward before the assembly.
I get the impression that he could put through as many news proposals as he had, and they still wouldn't go for it. The sense that I'm getting from even some in his own party is that they don't like the new proposal any much more than they like the old one. Several of them have used the analogy, why are they selling the cow when it's still giving them milk? They just don't see that it's necessary. And as one has told me, you know, he likes the governor, but he didn't run on ABC privatization.
I guess you too, Bob and Chris and Christina, you agree that the chances of this going anywhere this session are slight?
Is that slight to nil?
Yeah, it hasn't seemed to pick up even Republican support in the House, where you'd expect it to have more support, and the Senate is
a favorite tactic of a lot of Republican delegates when I approach them about the ABC bill is to walk away
and not get quoted.
And that's probably not because I didn't bathe, but I still don't know who the House sponsor of the bill is.
Christina, do you hear anything that is likely to add money to transportation this year other than selling off the booze stores?
Well, I would agree on ABC, and I think that, you know, really, I frankly haven't yet encountered a legislator who has actually read the latest report. And three times is a charm everywhere except politics. If you swing and miss the first time, it gets progressively more difficult if you just continue to bang on that same drum. So that's going to be very difficult. The bonds, you know, it's very interesting right now. The governor wants to borrow almost $3 billion in bonds. Some of those have been approved, but he wants to speed that all up and borrow it all during the rest of his term. And he wants to add an additional billion and change. And there are a lot of questions about that, too. I mean, frankly, ABC is pretty simple when you compared to some of these complex borrowing proposals that he's come up with. But it's interesting that he's getting more criticism from some of the Republicans in the House and even some Democrats in the Senate who are at least saying, well, I'm willing to look at that. And some of the mixed message that we're getting on that is that some of the business groups have decided that they are going to support the governor on the bond package. Now, these guys are fully aware that the bill is going to come due on all of this at some point, and they view it as part of a longer-term strategy to generate money, and if that involves Virginia first digging itself into a hole and then having to raise the gas or the sales tax later to get the state back out of that, then they're willing to do that if that's the only way after 20 years of trying to get some funding for roads, that they're willing to at least look at that as an option.
Christina Knuckles is an editorial writer and columnist for the Virginian Pilot in Norfolk. Shellyann Davis is a government politics reporter who covers Richmond for the Fredericksburg Freelance Star. When the General Assembly is in session, as it is now, and through the 28th or so of February, 26th, I guess, and Bob Lewis is a veteran political writer who's covering the state government here in Richmond for the Associated Press. I'm your host, Bob Gibson, Executive Director of the Sorenson Institute for Political Leadership at the University of Virginia. If you're listening to Assembly Conversations, give us a call at 866-611-NEWS. That's 866-611-6397. Our first caller is Tyler in Richmond. Tyler, welcome to Assembly Conversations. You're on with our distinguished panel of journalists.
Well, hi. I'd like the panel. I don't expect you to be able to come up with anything straight off the bat, but you might have a few ideas. But out of all those 1,900 or so action items for the Assembly this time around, could you boil that all down and just let the citizens know which ones are going to actually create jobs for the citizens of Virginia?
That's a good question. Let's start with Bob. Bob, you see any good jobs bills in those 1,900 bills and resolutions that are headed for the floors or
well,
the committees?
If you ask our jobs governor and his jobs lieutenant governor, he would say that the $50 million plus he's seeking for the governor's opportunity fund would be the best way to bring jobs in here. He would also point to the transportation package, which is appealing to business because, I mean, you know, let's face it, if you look at the economic engine of Virginia, Northern Virginia, and you experience a little of that gridlock around 0430 in Springfield, you might not be so kindly disposed to move up there or around Reston or someplace like that. Yeah, I think there are bills in there that can create jobs, but you know, how many of those jobs are going to be created by an improving economy? How many of them are going to be created by a well-financed and aggressive marketing and recruitment effort by the governor? That's hard to tell, but there are efforts to make the state even more attractive than it already is to business. Republicans would tell you today that that's what the constitutional amendment on right to work is. Those are the ones that I suppose the governor would point to. I think how successful they are, we're going to have to wait and see.
Christina, you see any good jobs bills in the pile of 1,900 plus?
It's always difficult with the economic development incentives to say whether they're creating jobs. For example, the money that the state gave to Northrop Grumman. Well, Northrop Grumman probably had an interest in being in close proximity to Washington, D.C., and so and it has already the shipyard, although it's going to spin that off in Virginia. So, you know, oftentimes incentives are just added on at the end once a corporation has decided what it's going to do anyway based on just other more basic business decisions. So there's a little bit of a game that's played, and it's always difficult to say what would have happened in the absence of those incentives. I think if, you know, whether it's built on debt or real money, if there are additional road projects, there will be new temporary construction jobs in Virginia, and that could be for quite some time if with some of these projects are quite major. So I think that that particular sector, yes, you can draw a direct line between the legislation and bills. But for the broader economic development, that's much more amorphous. It's harder to predict.
Thanks, Christina. And thanks, Tyler, for your call and question. Our next caller is Bob in Swope. Bob, welcome to Assembly Conversations. You're on with Christina and Shellyan and Bob Lewis.
Thanks for doing this. I hope you would be able to explain a bit about the politics of the payday lending legislation. That seems to me an interesting grassroots initiative. It started here in Stanton with the Stanton City Council asking Richmond to do something about it when Richmond hadn't. And now, as I understand it, quite a few other communities, counties, and cities have also taken such a position. And yet it doesn't seem to make a lot of difference in Richmond, whereas, according to the Stanton paper this morning, $1.4 million has been given by finance companies to the legislators since 1997. I think it's a bit perplexing because you would think that if you ask the public whether rates should be – anyone should be charged over 35% per annum interest, they would of course agree with that, and yet we let these companies do it, even though they're forbidden to do it with military personnel. So if you might explain what's going on, I'd appreciate it.
Okay, thank you. Christina Knuckles is one of our reporters here who follows the money. Christina, how is the money looking on that set of perennial bills that come here on payday lending?
Yes, most years, and frankly, there's a one person who stands in the way of getting any change, and that is Senate Majority Leader Dick Sasslaw. He is the chairman of the Commerce and Labor Committee in the Senate, and he kills off these bills that would cap the interest rate every year. Now, generally, his strategy is to drag this thing out throughout the session and kill them all at the end. He's kind of changed his mind this year. I guess he's got things on his mind with redistricting, and he went ahead and hauled off and whacked most of them yesterday, as a matter of fact. There are still a few knocking around alive in the House, but there, frankly, is not a strong base of support for the advocates for reform in either the House or the Senate on this. And so two parts of that, these companies give a lot of money, and this is an election year, and people would like to raise money this year for their reelection. So that's going on with the legislators. And the other part of it is that the businesses, you know, they tend to outsmart the legislature and always stay one step ahead. Payday loans in their original form are way down in Virginia. And now that title loans are starting to come under regulation, and that's a little more, fewer people are willing to give up their car title to get a loan, so that's not as popular of a predatory loan product. So now you have more companies that are going into these open-ended. It's kind of, one person described it yesterday as like a credit card with a 300% interest rate. So that is less regulated than the payday loan. So the companies just continue to change their business plan to stay out of the regulations that are passed by the legislature.
Which they can do faster than the legislature
Absolutely.
Can regulate them. Thank you, Bob, for your call and your question. Panel, we have a new city that's being proposed for the state of Virginia. Delegate Shuler of Blacksburg and Senator Deeds of Bath County have proposed a city of Allegheny Highlands, providing a new charter for the city of Allegheny Highlands, the city created by the consolidation of Allegheny County and the city of Covington. Are we going to get a new city in Virginia? It's been a while since we've had a city and county joined to become a city.
Well, you're looking at me, but I don't really understand the purpose of why they would do that. So I don't know. I don't really cover that area. I don't know what the advantage is.
Well, the cities can do certain things that counties can't do. Mm-hmm. So there's a little more flexibility and latitude for a city as a local government than there is for a county, which has to sort of get everything approved in Richmond, whereas a city charter has more that doesn't have to go to the voters and can be put into local government effect. Have you heard of either of those bills, and do you see any chance that we're going to get a new city, which we haven't had since about the 60s.
I just heard some talk about it. I suspect what it is you've got some local officials out there who came to Cree and came to Bud, and they said, hey, look, can you do this for us? And those bills usually don't get a lot of blowback. I mean, if a locality requests it, They don't encounter that much opposition from the other 138 lawmakers in the House and Senate.
Maybe if we have someone listening in the new city of Allegheny Highlands or in Allegheny County or it's the city of Covington, give us a call and you can fill us in on whether this is actually something that the two local governments have put together with the legislation being the icing on the cake.
I can't think of the last time something like that was done.
Well, in Tidewater, in Hampton Roads, of course, Princess Anne became part of Virginia Beach,
right.
And a couple of counties became Chesapeake and Suffolk, and on the north side in the peninsula, some changes were made back in the late 60s.
And Suffolk's a city, isn't it?
Suffolk is now an agricultural city, yes.
Yeah, it's like geographically one of the largest cities in America.
Right. So Allegheny Highlands would be a city but would be largely rural. There is a precedent for it under Virginia law.
Well, I mean, I agree with Bob that, you know, local charter bills don't get a lot of attention, but I could envision this one getting some blowback just because what kind of precedent it could set. I mean, are the people I cover going to want to create the city of Spotsylvania-burg or something next? I mean, if, you know, if counties want to start becoming cities, then, you know.
Especially in a time when the state has cut $1 billion out of local government budgets. And so I think that some of them are just trying to get a little creative in figuring out new ways that they might be able to recoup some of their money. And so this one option might be to become a city so that you can raise a meals tax a little bit easier. But I think there is the possibility that this one could be more controversial just because they have this fear that suddenly we'll have an outbreak of rural cities all over Virginia. And does this mean that the whole independent city concept will start to break down?
Our
next caller is Andrew in the small city of Lexington, Virginia, which has been a city for quite a while. Andrew, welcome to Assembly Conversations. You're on with Bob Lewis, Shelley Ann Davis, and Christina Knuckles.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate that. The reason why I was calling was I just had one small question for you. Last night I was on a website to deal with concealed carry and things, and they were listing one of the new proposals that's coming out very soon to where they're talking about you basically eliminate the need for a concealed carry permit in the state of Virginia. And the only requirement would be that you would, you know, identify yourself as having a concealed carry if you got pulled over or things like that. If that being the case and it gets passed, my question would be, how would that affect the reciprocity that we would have from other states that honor the concealed carry permits of the state of Virginia?
Andrew, that's a good question, and we'll turn first to Shelley Ann Davis.
Yeah, I did see that bill. I can't remember whose bill it is, maybe Carrico's bill. Basically, I think that's how Arizona has it, that if you can legally carry a gun, then you do not have to get a permit to carry it concealed. Currently, Virginia law requires you to get the permit. You can carry openly, but you have to have a permit to carry concealed, and so this bill would change that. I don't know what the ramifications would be on reciprocity with other states. I guess it would depend on whether those states want to continue having reciprocity with Virginia. I know there is another bill in that would, I think, expand reciprocity from our perspective, have Virginia accept concealed carry permits from every other state that has them. So typically those bills will probably get through the House pretty well, and they will probably I don't know. The Senate is not always predictable in that way, but I would not necessarily expect, especially that concealed carry permit one, to get far on the Senate side.
There's another Senate bill that Senator Emmett Hanger has, which would allow concealed permit carriers to keep their concealed permit information from being disclosed. That's a separate concealed carry bill that Senator Hanger has put forward this year.
I believe an exemption is already in that precludes concealed carry lists from being subject to FOIA.
I think you can't get the list, but I think you could go to the courthouse individual
this
ones.
This prevents the court clerks from giving out the information at the courthouse, and it's probably dubbed the Roanoke Times bill, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, guns, the gun lobby carries a lot of clout at this Capitol, and it always has since in the 12 sessions I've covered here. And I marveled yesterday. Yesterday was lobby day, and a lot of pro-gun people were there. And are we going away?
We are for about a minute.
We'll pick it up when we come
back. We will come back to guns and conceal carry and other of the 1900 bills and resolutions before the Virginia General Assembly when we come back to Assembly Conversations after this brief break.
Play us out, Maestro.
Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, supporting public discourse through sponsorship of Virginia Public Radio. Resources for parents and teachers online at veanea.org. More information about Assembly Conversations and other Virginia Public Radio programming can be found online at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.
Welcome back to Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. I'm your host, Bob Gibson, Executive Director of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership at the University of Virginia. We have three distinguished journalists with us who cover the Virginia General Assembly from start to finish, which is 45 days this year, as the Assembly started last Wednesday and goes 46 days exactly. Christina reminds me, because they always extend it to give it its maximum length during the short session, which is supposed to cover amendments to the budget, but it covers all sorts of things, including concealed carry permits and gun laws. How many of you all went to the rally yesterday on Capitol Square, where there were actually two rallies, one by gun rights advocates and one by gun control advocates? And did the two groups get any mixture? And
it was very civil. for the most part.
That's good because the television coverage showed a number of people packing.
Oh, yeah, they were packing. And what I was about to say, and before that beautiful music came on, I was standing in outside the General Assembly building where these people with the orange Gun Save Lives stickers, and a lot of them, too, several hundred probably, were queued up to enter the building and to go through metal detectors. Metal detectors set up to detect supposedly guns.
Knives.
And knives and other instruments of death. But I'm standing there watching the metal detector go off. Beep, beep, beep. And they say, step aside. And they step aside and they get wanded by a Capitol Police officer. And they go, okay, that's my gun that's making that beep. Okay, oh, that's a magazine in this pocket. And, oh, that's an extended barrel down in my other pocket. And then they show the license and concealed carry permit, and they say, "Okay, go ahead." So, why the magnetometers? Why the metal detectors?
Give us a call at 866-611-NEWS. That's 866-611-6397. If you have a question for our distinguished journalist, Shellyann Davis of the Fredericksburg Freelance Star, Christina Knuckles of the Virginian Pilot, and Bob Lewis of the Associated Press, there are a number of smaller bills that are percolating around the assembly that haven't been killed yet. One of them would require motorists to give bicycle riders 3 feet instead of 2 feet as they pass them on city streets. Shellyann, have you that's one of the Charlottesville bills that is percolating through the assembly. What sort of fate do you see for that?
I don't necessarily know that it'll get that far, but I don't. When we were talking about it earlier, my issues were more that, you know, the patrons should drive through the city of Richmond where the streets are very narrow and you don't have room to give the bicyclist 3 feet. And they don't always obey the stop signs and the stop lights. And that's all I've got on that one. You might ask Christina.
Christina, I know you had
an unpleasant
reaction. Bumping with a bicycle on the way over here. I hope that was resolved without any serious injury to anything other than a few spokes.
I think so. I hope so, too. This gets into it all depends on where this bill ends up. Sometimes the speaker will send these off to militia and police because he thinks it's too much of a nanny bill and that people should get out there and live and let live and sort things out among themselves. So who knows? I'm not really clear what the fate of this particular bill is. This can be quite a big deal, though, particularly in urban areas where traffic has picked up and it's hard to compete for the roadway in Virginia Beach. We have a lot of avid bikers and some in parts, believe it or not, parts of Virginia Beach are somewhat rural. And so people go out there to bike, but the traffic has really picked up and there's a little bit of aggressive activity going on out there. So it is becoming an issue in more and more communities. Whether they're ready to sort all of that out this year, I'm not quite clear.
Well, Charlottesville is trying to be a bike-friendly community, and it's been hard. It's been hard for people on bicycles to coexist on some of the city streets. We've had a number of accidents in recent months. Bob Lewis, let me ask you. There's a bill, actually a study resolution put in by Delegate Bob Marshall of Prince William County. Study the adoption of alternative currency establishes a joint subcommittee to study whether the Commonwealth of Virginia should adopt a currency to serve as an alternative to the currency distributed by the Federal Reserve System in the event of a major breakdown of the Federal Reserve System. What's going on with this bill?
Bob is such good copy. Don't you love that guy? He's automatically national wire material for me. Bob is courting the same constituency that has been very, very good to him for a very long time. People who are a little scared and a lot put off by a federal government, and he knows how to work that. That bill, as I say, is entertaining, but it has no chance at all to get past the first committee in the Senate. And so, you know, it is what it is. It's a good brochure bill. It'll help him not only in this re-election presumably, a re-election this fall. But in the election in 2012, when he plans to run for the U.S. Senate nomination, Republican Party, for Jim Webb's seat. So
Republicans and Tea Party people seem to be lining up for that that election. Isn't George Allen in line, Shelley?
Purportedly. He has not officially said so, but he's certainly done everything else. I mean, he's hinting. And
oh, the guy's running like Carl Lewis. I mean, he's in.
He's in, and he's got an event in Fredericksburg tomorrow morning, doesn't he?
An event in Fredericksburg, and then he's coming to Richmond, and then he's going elsewhere with Americans for Prosperity, I believe it is.
Right, so.
I don't know if that's an announcement tour. I presume not, but
it's a town hall tour. Yeah. Yes, but he's definitely getting plenty of FaceTime out there with folks, so I think that it's just a matter of time. You always do the teaser, especially when you are the prime, you know, the person to beat, and George Allen is the person to beat, even though astonishingly now he is the moderate in this contest. Who would have ever thought that would be the case?
But, and it may put him in a very good position to be the moderate in a field that seems to be filling up with people far to his right.
But, you know, his rhetoric has not been terribly moderate. I mean, he has definitely been talking sort of the Tea Party talking points himself.
AFP talking points. Yeah.
It's funny because, you know, he has pushed his party into going to a primary for the nomination for that office. And the Democrats seem to be going in the opposite direction, as their top two candidates for governor in 2013 appear to be angling for a convention instead of a primary, which has been the normal route for the Democrats in recent years. Let's get back to our callers. Charles in Appomattox is our next caller on Assembly Conversations. Charles, you're on with our three journalists.
A pleasure to be with you, and I really have to congratulate you on this extraordinary broadcast that you've done here. And I'm on the Appomattox County Board of Elections, and to have this kind of information come forth is really extraordinary. I'm so pleased to be able to listen to it. Please continue, and I thank you very much.
Do you have a question you'd like to ask of our panel today? Any legislation?
No questions, except when will you be on next?
Well, that's a good question. This program is set for every Tuesday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Initially, and then will be rebroadcast around Virginia. It will be rebroadcast in Norfolk on public radio on Wednesday at 1 p.m. in the afternoon. So there are about a dozen stations around the Virginia that are public radio stations carrying this program every week as the General Assembly is in session.
I'm a total fan, and I'm delighted to see you going forward. Have a good
evening. Thank you. Thank you very much, Charles. Our next caller is Jerry in Danville. Jerry, welcome to Assembly Conversations. You're on with our reporter panel.
Oh, hello. How you doing? Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering, the bill that was introduced by, actually a constitutional amendment introduced by John O'Brennan for the property tax exemption for disabled veterans, I believe that's passed and it's supposed to go into effect July 1. Is that discretionary by city, or are each city mandated to do that?
That's a good question. Usually when those bills pass, they are discretionary by nature, allowing the cities to Shelley,
are these the ones that were voted on last
Is this
November?
One of the questions that passed as a
I believe it is mandatory for that one. I believe it was discretionary for the aged tax relief, but for the 100% disabled veterans, it will be mandatory.
100%.
I thought that took effect last July 1st, didn't it?
No, it was on the ballot in November.
Yeah, we just passed it in November.
Never mind.
Yeah, okay. But you're right. It's a little known part of tax relief coming to disabled veterans in Virginia, and thank you for bringing that up.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call. Well, what's your favorite little bill going through the Assembly right now? Does anybody have one that they've run into in committee yet that has had an interesting lifespan of a week?
Well, one that I've been following with a lot of interest is the mortgage lending bill would require longer notice periods for banks and mortgage holders. It's an interesting issue that has brought together Democrats such as Don McEachin, Chap Peterson, Robin Abbott from Newport News, and my favorite,
Bob Marshall.
Bob Marshall, our most entertaining delegate. And I think it's a nettlesome bill in some ways, because I don't think it has a lot of admirers in the Republican House of Delegates, but they're afraid to kill it. I was in the Commerce and Labor Committee yesterday afternoon when they took it up. And, you get the tone, you get the idea in there that they're not fond of the bill, but they know that there are a lot of people out there awfully worried about the rash of foreclosures and the frustrating process that they encounter often when they go to their bank to try to find out, hey, how do I bring my mortgage up to date? How do I avoid foreclosure? Do you hold my mortgage? If not, who does? And according to the witnesses that testified yesterday, they're encountering a lot of I don't knows, a lot of equivocation, a lot of misinformation, and a whole lot of apathy from the banks as they try to save their homes.
So this little foreclosure relief bill would offer the relief of 30 days as opposed to just 14?
Well, one bill is 30 days, one bill is 45 days. Mm-hmm. And the stories we heard yesterday is that 14 days, which is the current limit, by the time you get your notice, you're almost at the foreclosure sale, and even with legal counsel, it's hard to contact the lender and make arrangements to save your house. There's a whole lot of record digging involved and things like that, and it's a bill that it's very complicated, very legalistic, but it is very real, and it not only concerns but scares a lot of people, the foreclosure crisis, that is. And so it's got a lot of grounding statewide in homes and families across Virginia.
You're listening to Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio with a panel of three distinguished journalists, Shelian Davis of the Fredericksburg Freelance Star, Christina Knuckles of the Virginian Pilot, and Bob Lewis of the Associated Press. Give us a call at 866-611-NEWS. That's 866-611-6397. If you have a question about the General Assembly ongoing, our next caller is Jinx in Charlottesville. Jinx, welcome to Assembly Conversations.
Thank you, Bob. I'm a dog with a bone. I cannot let go of the idea that the Citizens United ruling in the Supreme Court was just the end of the Constitution. Is there any movement in the legislature to counter it?
I haven't heard of any. Bob, have you heard?
I don't know that there's much the legislature in Virginia can do about it. It's a federal issue.
Besides me?
Well, oh, yeah, a lot of people are, including a lot of journalists.
It seems to be a congressional issue to be tackled first in Washington. I don't know what the states could do. There are some interesting federal issues floating around here in Richmond, so there's probably a way of looking at it as a federal issue that the states could do something with. But it has to do with unlimited amounts of money being funneled into campaigns by corporations that are given the given citizenship, right?
That's
and that,
right.
Does that not affect state politics?
Well, it does.
It does.
Do not corporations have the right to funnel money anywhere they want, completely secretly?
Well, you're talking about two different structures. There's the federal election system and the state election system, and the laws governing federal and state elections are different. In Virginia, a lot of that has been avoided in the past because Virginia puts no limits on spending or how much you can raise if you're a candidate.
Where does the money come from?
The money comes from corporations, from wealthy individuals. And you know what? Exactly who they are, it's impossible to find because they've found a way now to give money through 501 organizations, charitable, nonprofit, advocacy groups that don't have to disclose their donors. And that's a big problem. It was a big problem for us last year. All sorts of groups that were terribly opaque set themselves up and gave huge sums of cash in the election that were essentially untraceable. Right. What happens, it seems, that every time Congress enacts some more federal legislation, like McCain-Feingold, there are cracks that people find in it that ultimately confound the whole point of the legislation, and that is to make the whole process more transparent. I mean, in Virginia, it's got its flaws. Our laws sometimes don't have enough teeth to enforce disclosure. But, you know, we are able to track campaign giving fairly well because some people don't bother setting up these organizations because it's just too easy to cut a check for, say, $100,000 if you're some wealthy giver and do it that way. You're not forced to hide and do it through a 501c organization.
Thank you, Jinx. Thank you very much for your call and your question. And we'll get back to you if we discover a bill that has anything to do with closing these problem contributions opened up in that Citizens United case. Our next caller is Joanne in Nellie's Ford. Joanne, welcome to Assembly Conversations. You're on with our three journalists.
Great. Thank you so much. I appreciate the panel. This information is just wonderful. But the question, I work with, my colleagues work with a lot of state employees, helping them plan for retirement, et cetera. And the big issue for them, of course, now is what's going to happen to the VRS pension through the General Assembly. So I'd appreciate it if you would address that issue.
That's a big issue. Christina, you want to take that first?
Of all the complicated issues, this is the number one. The governor has proposed, and we will definitely see some reforms to the retirement system this year, the governor is proposing that the state will start to pay a larger share into the system for each of its employees. It's also requiring each state employee now to pay a portion. And if you recall, they had made the decision last year that they would require new employees to pay part of their toward their pension benefits. Now everyone will have to do the same so that they don't end up with two different groups of state employees. Similar situation is going to happen with the teachers. Local governments will start making their own decisions on what they're going to do with theirs. In reality, all of this is a positive in that, well, you know, obviously for the state employees, they're going to see a reduction in the amount of money that they are bringing in. But in terms of trying to prop up that pension fund, it does mean more money going in. But frankly, remember that the legislature didn't pay $700 million into the pension fund that it should have last year. So what they're really doing is saying we're going to pay a little bit more, but we're still not actually making up for all that we didn't pay last time.
Well, it's not the state employees who caused the problem, is it, Shelley?
Well, no. I mean, you know, they've been having their portion of the pension paid all these years, and now, you know, it's not their fault, but the VRS did lose a lot of money in the, in the recession. You know, a lot of its money is investments, and that went away, and they're making it back. But my understanding is it's not, you know, going to come back in fast enough or enough, get a rate of return that's enough to build back up. So what I think I'm hearing from some lawmakers is eventually, probably not this year, but eventually they would like to see the retirement plans for state employees move away from a pension plan and towards something like a 401k.
This may hasten that. Bob Lewis, what are the politics of this?
Well, the politics of it are they borrowed from the pension fund last year, and so they're sitting there with egg on their face. The pension borrowing is really just maybe, you know, a maraschino cherry on top of this huge parfait. It's really not at the heart of the problem. But they've got to look like they're doing something to bail out the state's employees. I think What this is a gradual step-by-step process in which the state becomes more like the private sector, where pensions are being frozen or in some cases discontinued. I know with my company, our pensions are being frozen. New hires don't get to join the pension system. They go with a 401k route. I think eventually you're going to see government follow the private sector and go to more of a directed benefit type of retirement plan instead of a instead of a pension type.
Thank you, Joanne.
Defined benefit.
Thanks very much for your call and your question. It's a big issue down here and for state employees and teachers across the Commonwealth.
Yeah, it's a pay cut is what it amounts to.
It is a pay cut.
It's hard to take in these times, but, you know.
After 3 years of no raises for most.
Right.
Our next caller is Nancy in Charlottesville. Nancy, welcome to Assembly Conversations. You're on with our three journalists.
Hello. This is my question. I would like to see Mr. Cuccinelli attacking things like predatory lending, but instead I find that he's spending money on attacking people like Michael Mann. Full disclosure, we know Michael Mann. I'm wondering how much money the state government has spent to, you know, you told us how much the University of Virginia has spent to defend or prevent.
Right, $350,000 to date.
How much money the government is spending on this?
That's a good question because I'm not sure anyone knows outside the Attorney General's office.
It's a figure that's very easy to hide because the Attorney General says it's hard to quantify because the Attorney General says, well, look, you know, we've got these staff people. They're going to be working on something. And that's true. They're paid a salary. They're not going out and hiring independent legal counsel to do this, which would be one way you could very easily see what the bills for it are. The question is, it's not where do you go to see what they're spending, it's what other issues don't get done. And I guess then it becomes a political question instead of a financial one.
Christina, do you want to add anything to that?
Yes, I guess, you know, ultimately the Mr. Cuccinelli's job is to advise state agencies with problems they have, and if he and his staff are neglecting those duties, that will manifest itself perhaps in unpleasant ways in the future if they're falling down the job. But at this point, we don't know of anything in particular.
Thank you, Nancy. Thanks for your call and your question. Our next caller is Steve in Stanton. Steve, welcome to Assembly Conversations. You're on with our panel of journalists.
Yes, thank you, and thanks for this show. It's very great, and of course we're listening on Virginia Public Radio, and I know that our governor has suggested that we shouldn't be funding public radio, and over the past few weeks it's occurred to me, and I sort of took pleasure in sort of counting all the shows and all the information that I get over National Public Radio that's directly related to our government and what's going on with government. So I'd like for the panel to be political and tell me what they're in the news media. So tell me what you think of that defunding National Public Radio in Virginia.
Okay, thank you very much for your call and your question. It's not just National Public Radio; it's public broadcasting as well, including the public TV stations across the state. What's going to happen to the governor's amendment?
I think that that's something that will probably be fought out in budget conference because I would expect that amendment will survive the House version of the budget. And probably not the Senate version, and especially with the PBS funding. I know Christina and I both don't have cable. We rely very heavily on PBS to give us something that is not Dancing with the Stars. So,
Bob, what do you think?
I admit I watch public television and listen to some NPR on the way in to work. I think the governor is probably going to get some reductions as he did last year. I don't think he's going to get it defunded. Because as Shellian's got it absolutely right, it all goes to the budget. You know, everybody gets all excited about each incremental step in the budget from the time it's introduced by the governor in December to the House reports out its committee version, Senate its committee version, and these little amendments that come and go along the way. And I think today was the deadline for budget amendments. But the real horse trading occurs in the final 3 or 4 days of the session when, you know, a dozen old guys huddle up in the 9th and 10th floors of the General Assembly building and basically decide how the budget's going to be cut up. And
but
I don't think
those
the Senate's going to let this happen.
Don't those dozen guys know going in that the Senate isn't going to let this happen, therefore the House...
Sure.
The House gets a twofer. They get a political...
Yes.
It's a negotiating point.
They get to make a point with their base if they're Republican delegates who are voting this through in the House, and then they get a concession from the Senate negotiators to take it out.
It's a chit. But, you know, I mean, the discouraging thing for public broadcasting is that if it's not a core service, good things are not going to happen over the next few years. Yeah, our revenues are picking up. We saw a 9.5% increase in December revenues when you allow for the amnesty action a year ago. But you don't see the kind of robust recovery and a robust bounce back in revenues that you're going to need to get back to funding things the way we did 4 or 5 years ago. And no matter who's in the governor's office, things that aren't direct core services, health care, things like that, are going to have problems. They did with Tim Kaine, a Democrat. Tim proposed cuts to, I think, public broadcasting.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks for your call and your question. Our next caller is Sandy in Salem. Sandy, welcome to Assembly Conversations. You're on with our journalist panel.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm interested in asking a follow-up question about the Virginia retirement system. For state employees who are not in the Virginia retirement system, who instead are in optional retirement plans, is there anything in the language of the bill that also suggests that people in the optional retirement plans will be having to contribute more or make mandatory contributions? Are we going to see changes there as well?
Are you talking about higher ed?
Yes, I am. I'm a state employee at a public university.
I would think that's where it would apply, and I don't know the answer to that. Do you, Christina?
I'm not sure, and that is not the source of the unfunded problems with the pension fund. So exactly how the university employees get treated in all of this, I think, is still subject to some change and discussion. Remember, there are several big bills out there. That is a small piece of it, but obviously that's important to you. There is not an issue with the pension benefits and future liabilities there. So it's kind of you get caught in the middle of it.
Thank you, Christina. Thank you, Shillian, and thank you, Bob.
I'm afraid that good
thank
music.
You.
Time is up. The good music is rolling. I want to thank all of you for joining us on Assembly Conversations. Next Tuesday, Assembly Conversations will feature Virginia Secretary of Transportation Sean Connaughton with host Tom Graham.
Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools, VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org, and by listeners of this Virginia Public Radio member station. Listeners can hear this program again or access other Virginia Public Radio news content at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.